This week, 250 top scientists signed a statement published in the journal Science that global warming is real and that we are responsible and that the climate research stacks up. But the question is, what are we, the public, supposed to make of such a statement? You don't do science by plebiscite. You don't have a vote on it and then the most popular findings get accepted. Either it's the truth or it isn't. Which is where the philosophers come in. And the sceptics. And here I mean the Sceptics Organisation, as pioneered in this country by the likes of Dick Smith. Dick was always keen to get the dowsers and the ufologists and the crystals healers and past life therapists sorted out. And as a philanthropist, geographer, aviator and all-round good bloke, helped set up the Australian Sceptics some decades ago. And now they're flourishing as never before, and Erin Segev, who lives in Sydney, has taken over as their new leader to tackle problems of this troublesome century.
As the president of Australian Skeptics, I have an understandable interest in knowing when the organisation is mentioned in the media. One way of finding out is by setting up a Google Alert, which notifies me by email when the search term is mentioned anywhere on the web. Over the past year, I have noticed that an increasing proportion of such alerts have nothing to do with Australian Skeptics, the organisation. Rather, they mention climate change skeptics who happen to be Australian. This is obviously not the first time that the word skeptic has been used outside the context of scientific scepticism and critical thinking, which are the core values of Australian Skeptics and sister organisations around the world. Indeed, anyone who finds any statement dubious can justifiably claim to be skeptical, even if such a position is ludicrous in the face of available evidence. But since Australian Skeptics, the organisation, does care about what is true or false, evaluating evidence becomes the principal method of determining whether a claim is worthy of acceptance. For a critical thinker or scientific skeptic, it is appropriate to suspend skepticism and provide provisional acceptance to a position that is supported by sufficient evidence. Having said that, judging whether there is sufficient evidence is not always straightforward. Climate change is a case in point. Climate science is interdisciplinary, encompassing atmospheric science, oceanography, glaciology, geology, physics, chemistry, and even astronomy, and I've probably left out several other disciplines. It is therefore not surprising that the number of people who really understand climate science is very small, probably numbering in the tens of thousands globally. Yet ask almost anyone and they'll have an opinion about climate change, not just about political or economic questions, but also about the core questions of whether and how much humans influence the Earth's climate. The reason people have an opinion is because they are concerned and feel a need to be involved in the debate. But the information presented to the public is often too confusing to be of any help. This leaves the non-expert in a position where they have to use their gut more than their brain to form an opinion. Using the wrong organ for any task can lead to injury, and that is also the case here. So what is an interested citizen to do when faced with a need to form an opinion on a matter about which they have no relevant expertise? One answer is in using a few rules of thumb for assessing evidence, and I will dedicate the next few minutes to discussing those rules. I should clarify in advance that not all rules apply in every case, and that there are additional methods of assessing evidence which I will not mention. However, these five rules of thumb will cover most cases. I will get back to climate change later on. But it's probably best to start with simpler topics, not all of which are from the realm of science. The first rule is in the name of this program. Occam's razor is the principle that entities shall not be multiplied unnecessarily. A less 14th century way of saying this is that a simpler explanation should take precedence over more complex ones. A great example of this is with regard to government errors of policy or neglect. These are often claimed to be a conspiracy, but could also be explained as some combination of thoughtlessness, laziness, and bad luck. The former requires coordination between multiple conspirators, long-term planning, and flawless execution, not to mention the ability to keep a secret indefinitely. The latter requires people in government to have normal human frailties. I think you see where I'm going with this. Similarly with evolution versus creation. Despite its amazingly complex results, evolution is a very simple process. All it requires are semi-stable replicators, which can be very simple molecules, such as the precursors to the DNA in the cells of every living thing. Creation requires God, which is only simpler in a spelling contest, not in its ability to explain the diversity of life on Earth. God is a huge assumption, which raises a host of new and very complex questions. It should be noted that it is possible for the more complex explanation to be more correct than the simpler one, but it is uncommon and generally would be rather extraordinary. Which brings us to the second rule, based on the saying by Carl Sagan, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. An example of an extraordinary claim is homeopathy. The basis of this practice is to dilute a substance in water to an extreme degree. So extreme, in fact, that it is highly unlikely that the dilution contains even a single molecule of the original substance. Homeopaths claim that this extreme dilution can cure the very same symptoms that the original substance would usually cause. If this idea were true, then caffeine diluted in water to homeopathic levels should cure insomnia, which is indeed what homeopaths say happens. The reason this claim is extraordinary is because for it to be true, it would require almost everything we know about physics, chemistry, and pharmacology to be wrong. That in itself does not make the claim wrong, but it means the evidence required for accepting homeopathy must be extremely strong. Unfortunately for homeopathy, that's not the case, but I shall not dwell on that in this program. The most common evidence provided for homeopathy, as well as for many other alternatives to scientific medicine, is in the form of testimonials. These are simply personal anecdotes such as, "My son got the MMR vaccine and it caused him to become autistic." The problem with such anecdotes is that they are based on feeling, not fact. The example I just gave would usually be the result of autism being diagnosed around the age of 2, a time during which quite a few vaccines are given to children. But the two things happen at the same time does not mean that they are related. Millions of children receive millions of vaccinations every year, and some of them will be diagnosed as autistic. Others will, no doubt, have other serious ailments, yet some other children will be shown, around the same time, to be of particularly high intelligence. None of these things is necessarily caused by vaccines, which is why statistical analysis is required to see if the incidence of any diagnosis varies between large numbers of vaccinated versus unvaccinated children. There is, by the way, plenty of solid evidence that vaccines are extremely safe and very effective, which leads us to the conclusion that is our third rule. The multiple of anecdote is not evidence. The corollary of this rule is that a single anecdote is certainly not evidence. The fourth rule is quite simple. Experts do know more. An electrician who spent a few years at TAFE, then worked as an apprentice and has been working independently for 10 years, knows a lot more about electrical work than a handyman who dabbles in electrical work from time to time. Similarly, a GP knows more about immunizations than a layperson who has been doing their research on the web, and an infectious disease expert knows more about the topic than the GP. And a veteran atmospheric scientist knows more about the atmosphere than a geologist. Listening to a specialist expert is significantly more likely to lead to the truth than following the advice of an interested but otherwise unqualified non-expert. The last rule is, in a way, an amalgamation of the previous rules. The rule is to trust science. When talking about science in this context, I refer to the scientific method rather than to areas of science such as physics or chemistry. The scientific method is a self-correcting process in which the ultimate goal of the participants is to find out whether a claim is true or not, with the final arbiter being the available evidence. Since the participants, also known as scientists, are human, this process does not always run smoothly. But time and again, the self-correcting nature of the process ensures that over time we get ever closer to the truth. The story of Barry Marshall and Robin Warren and the discovery of H. pylori as the cause of stomach ulcers is a great example of both the frailties of science and the ultimate victory of evidence over preconceptions. For a non-scientist to evaluate the state of the art on a scientific issue, there are essentially two questions that need to be considered. One, has a proper scientific process been followed? And were there no obvious failings in the manner by which scientists arrived at a certain conclusion? And two, is there a scientific consensus on the topic? Both questions need to be answered in the affirmative in order for the scientific answer to be accepted. The term scientific consensus is often misused or misunderstood. A consensus arises when a significant majority of working scientists in the relevant field or fields, and the majority of scientific organizations in those fields, and the majority of scientific papers published in credible peer-reviewed scientific journals all point in roughly the same direction. It does not mean a vote was held, and there is no suggestion that there are no dissenting voices, or even that the consensus could not be wrong, as it most certainly can be. What it does mean is that those who are most able to judge the evidence, the experts have largely been convinced by it. In the case of climate change, there is a strong consensus that the world is warming and that humans have been playing an important role in this warming. Importantly, the consensus has not been arrived at easily or quickly. Climate change has been debated and studied for at least 25 years, yet it is only in the past few years that this consensus has arisen. That's the way good science works. Scientists are skeptical people, and it takes a lot of very good evidence to convince them. Furthermore, experience suggests that a consensus that has emerged due to the accumulation of new evidence is more likely to be correct. As for proper scientific process, there is no reason to believe that it has not been followed in the case of climate change. While there have been suggestions by some dissenters that there is a conspiracy or mass delusion amongst the majority of scientists, no compelling evidence has been provided for such claims, nor is it likely that that could be the case. Suggestions of impropriety by some scientists, even if proven, are not evidence of a grand conspiracy, and the claim of conspiracy in this case contradicts at least two of the previous rules. Since both questions have been answered in the affirmative, the theory of climate change by human-induced carbon forcing is likely to be correct, to the best of the current scientific understanding. In closing, I would like to note that coming to this conclusion does not mean subscribing to the proposition that the world is about to end, or that any specific solutions are going to be effective. Apart from reducing our dependence on fossil fuels and limiting all manners of pollution, which are positive steps regardless of climate change, most solutions are heavily based on economic and social factors. While the first four rules can be applied to these factors too, they are difficult to investigate scientifically, and it is therefore more difficult to come to a conclusion about them. In such cases, it is best to simply say, "I don't know, I don't have an opinion, I will wait until there is more evidence."
Evidence, the essential ingredient. Aaron Segev, president of the Australian Skeptics. And they have a magazine of that name, Australian Skeptic, with all their musings on a wide range of topics, from fructose and obesity, as featured on this very program, to Simon Singh and chiropractors and other matters of skeptical debate. Well, a couple of centuries ago, people were also skeptical about nurses. They thought of them as little more than scrubbers, in both senses, floozies, skivvies and pisspots, like Sarah Gamp in Charles Dickens. Dr. Jim Leversley has a higher opinion of nurses and revisits Florence Nightingale and an anniversary next week at this time. I'm Robin Williams.